This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
Just exploiting you and using your time. No, you should take all that you need, either from the shop or from the cash machine. Don't let him tell you how you need to act. Tell him you quit and never go back. Don't trust a boss and don't do what he say. This time will be over, soon come the day. A cop, kick him in the shins, run away, don't stop. Gotta get away so you can fight again another day. Come back tomorrow and blow him away. Pigs are just thugs, they're up to no good. Just causing shit in your neighborhood. Don't trust the cops and don't do what they say. Their time will be over, soon come the day. Go back to school, don't follow no teacher, don't follow no rules. No, you can learn outside of class. You don't need to pay, you don't need to pass. Don't trust the teachers or the knowledge they guard. If you really want to learn, get a library card. Don't trust the teachers, don't do what they say. Their time will be over, soon come the day. Singing this song, you might like the singing, you might hum along. But if you don't like the words that I say, well, that's fine by me, you can go your own way. Don't let me tell you how you need to be. Think for yourself and that's how you get free. Don't trust the singing, don't do what I say. My time will be over, soon come the day. My time will be over, soon come the day.
AWOL Radio here, 100.3 Sound FM, soundfm.ca. Check out peaceculture.org for all things AWOL, AWOL Radio. Rabble Podcast Network, rabble.ca. We'll be uploading all throughout the weekend. The last few bits I've received, I've recorded, or whatever. It's been an exciting and trying couple of weeks, but we've gotten a couple leaked documents, and we're going to talk about those probably next week. But a little tasty treat for you. So check out AWOL Radio next week. We'll get into it a lot more. We're going to have to be jumping right into things. Obviously, a little late. It's Friday, the 29th of June, 2012. And good news from Barrier Lake. As Barrier Lake activists acquitted for blockade charges, the forest company has been caught lying, and it is a press release posted on activist communique at rabble.ca, Chris Line Krause's blog. For immediate release, Barrier Lake, Algonquin acquitted for blockade charges. Forest Company caught lying on the stand. And this happened on June 5th, 2012. Norman Matchuan, a youth spokesperson for the First Nations of the Algonquins of Barrier Lake, was acquitted on what community members alleged all along were politically motivated charges. Matchuan was acquitted of mischief and obstruction of justice stemming from a 2009 blockade protecting his people's territory from illegal logging. Matchuan was defending the forest from logging that had been unlawfully authorized by the Quebec's Ministry of Natural Resources. The logging was also a violation of resource co-management agreement signed in 1991 between Barrier Lake and Quebec and Canada. "Too many native peoples are criminalized for defending their land," said Matchuan, following the acquittal, continuing, "Today is a big victory for our community. We will not be intimidated by trumped-up legal charges and court battles. We will always protect our land and customs for our future generations," unquote. Yves Paquette of Abitibi Boatwater, the forestry company behind the cutting, incriminated himself by repeatedly lying during his cross-examination. Paquette claimed that he encountered no police on the site and was not able to enter the site because the logging road was entirely blocked by the cars of the Barrier Lake community members. However, after seeing video evidence that refuted the latter claim, Paquette also admitted to speaking to two intelligence officers from the Sûreté du Québec, or the SQ. Vincent Larenne of the Quebec Ministry of Natural Resources admitted on the stand that logging permits were issued without any consultation by his ministry of the family groups whose territories were being logged. Moreover, after first claiming that the cutting permits could not be altered once they were electronically signed and entered into the ministry's computer system, he presented the court with a cutting permit that was substantially different than the version that had been disclosed to the defense. Quote, "They got caught in their own lies," said Matchuan following the trial, continuing, "The Crown's case in the end was so weak that they were not even required to present a defense," said Jared Will, the lawyer representing Matchuan at trial. Last year, the community of Barrier Lake discovered a copper and nickel exploration project at the heart of the hunting and fishing area of several Barrier Lake families. The mineral claims, named the Rivière Dorée property by Cartier Resources, was recently sold to Copper One Inc., based in Montreal. Neither the Quebec government nor Cartier Resources had met their obligations to obtain the consent of the community before beginning work on the site. Matchuan was a key voice in the community's successful struggle to stop the exploration activity by Cartier Resources. Soon after he became active in the anti-mining campaign, he was issued a summons to appear in court for the logging blockade that occurred over 2 years earlier. And again, you can check that out on rabble.ca. Barrier Lake activists acquitted for blockade charges. Forestry company caught lying. And a piece also posted earlier in the month on the Toronto Media Co-op, "We are not against windmills." On Monday, May 28th, members of Six Nations pulled out the surveying stakes of archaeologists working for the multinational corporation Samsung, who hopes to build a multi-billion-dollar wind project in the area. The confrontation erupted following the multinational corporation's refusal to submit an application to the Haudenosaunee Development Institute, or the HDI, an arm of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council, one of the competing entities that claims jurisdiction over the land. Quote, "We are not against windmills or renewable energy. We endorse and support it when done in a manner that complies with basic regulatory processes we have established," said Aaron Detlor, a representative of HDI. Some Ontario environmentalists have expressed concern that members of Six Nations are opposing a project to create renewable energy. Quote, "We can't apply our process selectively, as it would make it impossible to deal with industry we have greater concerns with," said Detlor, pointing to a proposal by Enbridge that may bring tar sands oil through Six Nations land. Samsung had previously refused to submit an application for the project and pay a $7,000 application fee. However, following the confrontation, Samsung did submit the application and payment, according to The Sun. Samsung asked for the lifting of a cease and desist order placed on the project by the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council. However, HDI has indicated that it needs to take time to process the application and have the matter brought before the chiefs. "Not everyone acknowledges HDI's jurisdiction to approve or deny development projects." The Toronto Sun referred to them as native dissidents, explaining that Six Nations elected band council has already expressed its approval for Samsung's proposed project. "The divergent views to the complex politics of Six Nations, a traditional government has existed for over 1,000 years, and in 1924 the federal government imposed a band council system. Both systems of government claim legitimacy. The conflict in the community was recently inflamed when the elected band council chief, Bill Montour, said he would call in the OPP if protesters stopped work on Samsung's project. HDI also claims jurisdiction to lands over which Ontario and several municipalities claim competing jurisdiction. According to HDI, they had previously raised $800 million in equity funding and approached Samsung with the offer to share revenues on the project. They had asked for 1.5% of energy sales, a percentage the province has developed for revenue-sharing projects with First Nations. Quote, "We tried to create revenue-sharing with Samsung in the province as a way of dealing with the regulatory process. However, they refused to deal in good faith on the issue," explained Detlor. Detlor said he wanted environmentalists who are concerned with the actions of the HDI to realize this is an archaeological issue. Quote, "An archaeological issue is different than a windmill issue. It is digging up our ancestors' remains without permission," unquote. Samsung was asked for comment and has still not responded to the Toronto Media Co-op, and that article was posted by Tim Groves. The six-month occupation of the Gikstan Treaty office ends in Hazelton, and this was posted in the Vancouver Sun. The protest in the Northwest BC village began when a hereditary chief signed an agreement with Enbridge to support the proposed Northern Gateway oil pipeline from Alberta to the BC coast, which was immediately denied by the rest of the band, it seemed. The dispute escalated amid complaints by blockade organizers that Native negotiators were spending millions of dollars during the treaty process, but had made little headway. With RCMP officers standing by, auditors from Aboriginal and Northern Development Canada entered the office and secured computers that will allow them to audit of Gikstan finances. Gikstan Chief Treaty Negotiator Bev Clifton Percival says the society agreed to an audit as an act of goodwill to appease the protesters and clear them out of the office. And we reported earlier on the deal that was made and immediately disgraced. Now, on June 9th, 2012, White Citizen Council, CANACE, the ridiculously labeled Canadian Advocacy for Charter Equality, some crap like that, led by Gary McHale. Back June 9th, they tried to come to the front entrance of Gonestaten at in Caledonia and pick up parts of the front gate to that site. They were trying to inflame violence. At one point, one of their supporters, one of the Fleming brothers, was attacking a piece of a large table with an axe, continuously hitting this big table with an axe at one of the entrances, until one of the Six Nations land defenders drove their truck up to it, at which point Fleming went even faster, attacking this table even more. Trying to inflame and incite. These folks are they're a White Citizens Council. We will be looking at them, and we are looking at them as similar to the racist councils in the South in the 60s. These people are trying to get Six Nations land defenders arrested. Gary McHale, for instance, at this July 9th action, went to the OPP claiming that Flower, who is a land defender, was driving the truck and ordered the OPP to arrest her. Of course, Flower was arrested after Gary McHale and company were emboldened by a large police presence and enabled by the police to walk onto the site. Flower, resisting that, was arrested later and charged with assault, and we'll hear more about that later. What CANACE did was, of course, disgraceful, and the very few supporters there were speaking in circles. They were arguing in circles and speaking with, you know, presenting hypocritical information or an obvious lack of understanding of the situation down there, not understanding that we are settlers on this land, that we have existing living treaty agreements and obligations through other types of agreements to the people of Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee, and every other Indigenous community on Turtle Island. Gary McHale and company don't quite understand that. They give hypocritical examples. I'm not going to talk about them anymore, other than they're all, apparently McHale is going to continue coming to the site in Gonestaten, Six Nations territory, just outside of the Caledonia borders. to continue trying to take down these the front gate to the site in an obvious attempt to flare the underlying racist sentiments in the white settler community in Caledonia, as they've been doing with many organizations over the last few years down there since 2006, when this land defense started. Well, from the Live Free Collective in St. Catharines, in solidarity with land defender Francine Doxator, the Live Free Collective and the Friends of Gonestaten and QP 4207 stand in solidarity with the Haudenosaunee land defender, grandmother, and April 28th coalition member Francine Flower Doxator. Flower is a friend and an inspiration, and we denounce the repression and criminalization of land defenders. Francine's charges stem from the trespass of white rights activist and bigot Gary McHale, and we call on non-Native allies to build up their side of the Goswenta, or the Two-Row Wampum, and confront the racist, neocolonial members of our community, be they individuals, politicians, bureaucrats, or organizations. The status quo will not be tolerated, in solidarity with all those who defend the earth. And again, that's from the Live Free Collective. And we'll get into a little more discussion. Francine, Flower was in Toronto. Well, she's been forced to Toronto under bail conditions. And she was at an amazing speaking event last Monday, the day before Alex Hundert was sentenced to 13 and a half months for his participation in G20 protest planning. And they spoke alongside other very powerful people. We're going to be presenting that audio on AWOL Radio, if you'll listen in. But Flower spoke very passionately and powerfully. Also spoke, we'll hear a bit when we get into the Alex Hundert sentencing trial. We'll hear a little more from Flower. Now, we've spoken about the Ashkenazdig camp, the Anishinaabe Confederacy to invoke our nationhood. Of course, happening in Owenda Provincial Park. You can check out our Rabble podcast about the Ashkenazdig camp. That's OSHKIMAADZIIG.org for more information on that, and our Rabble podcast, just the name without the .org. Well, Tuesday, June 11th, 2 weeks ago, two young men from the Anishinaabe community of Beausoleil First Nations, located in the southern shores of Georgian Bay near Penetanguishene, Ontario, will be handing in their status cards at the Ontario Regional Indian Affairs branch in Toronto in an attempt to emancipate themselves from the Indian Act. This action happened, and the branch would not accept them. They said, go down to Brantford, go to the branch down there to deal with that. Quote, being chained to the Indian Act is not representative of who we are as the Anishinaabe nation. By agreeing to these status cards, we are agreeing to accept policies that are in breach of our nation-to-nation agreements we have with the Crown, explains Richard Peters, one of the Anishinaabe men. The two Anishinaabe men are also currently reoccupying their people's traditional territories, where for the past 3 months they have established reclamation encampments in Coldwater, Ontario, and Owenda Provincial Park, in opposition of their community's acceptance of the Coldwater Narrows Experiment Settlement Offer, which calls for the absolute surrender of their traditional territories. Quote, we are not Indians, we are Anishinaabe with agreements with the Crown. Through this action, we are publicly announcing our emancipation from the Indian Act and reject the representation from any Indian Act governed entities that claim authority over the sovereignty of the Three Fires Anishinaabe Confederacy. We acknowledge that the Indian Act Band Chief and Councils are modern-day Indian agents who are accountable to the Canadian state. This action is not to be mistaken as an extinguishment of our entitlement to the established treaties. We will be taking future agreements where treaty entitlements and lands are not to be withheld or governed within the illegal Indian Act Band system, unquote, explains Johnny Hawk, one of the other men at the site. The pair are re-establishing Anishinaabe clan governance and traditional Indigenous alliances at these camps. They will be rescinding their Indian status at 1 p.m. at the, or they tried to, as I said, in Toronto, and they were denied. Check out oshkimazdig.org, OSHKIMAADZIIG.org. For more information, they have been putting out videos. They've been presenting workshops, and they're organizing speaking tours. We will be playing more of their audio next week. And as well as hosting representatives from the Ashkenazdig camp in Kitchener-Waterloo in the next month or so. Now we're going to go to a tune. This is a Tribe Called Red with NDNs from All Directions here on... And that was A Tribe Called Red with NDNs from All Directions. Check it out on rpm.fm or tribecalledred.com. Going to more news around Canadian mining. Of course, Canadian mining has been long targeted by Indigenous groups, Canadian mining companies around the world, as they continue, companies like Barrick Gold, like Eldorado, some of the other larger, or all of the Canadian mining companies, as far as I have had information, are disrespecting Indigenous lands, Indigenous rights around the world, and Just like everybody's rights. They're destroying lands and communities around the world. And here we have from the Vancouver Media Co-op, posted by Don Paley, who has been writing for years on Canadian mining companies and their impact around South America. Well, here's the story: Greek protests against Vancouver's Eldorado Gold. Government push to bring in new mines as solution to economic woes rejected by residents. As people in Greece fight austerity in the streets, top officials are pushing open-pit mining as a way out of the country's economic despair. But just as folks in Greece have taken action against an imposed economic paradigm, they are taking a stand to protect their lands from mining. Quote, state corporate propaganda claims that the exploitation of mineral wealth is the only way for Greece to get out of the recession, and mineral concessions are very high in the list of assets to be sold off, unquote. Maria Kadoglou of the Anti-Gold Greece told the Vancouver Media Co-op by email. People in northern Greece have organized over the last 17 years to keep the coastal regions of northern Greece free of toxic mining projects. But the threat of new gold mines has been renewed over the past couple of years, and this time there is only one company in the game, Vancouver-based Eldorado Gold Corporation. According to Kadoglou, the proposed Skouries mine in the center of the conflict, the company claims there is 3.6 million ounces of gold as well as copper at the site, and the company has already received environmental permits. People working for Eldorado fenced off the site, and tensions with locals, especially around forests and water, have been mounting ever since. Quote, people protesting the Canadian occupation of the mountain found that the company had protection from the Greek police, which threw tear gas and flashbang grenades at the people, despite presence of women and children and the elderly, Kodoglou told the Vancouver Media Co-op. Videos of the march and the police repression are available. They're posted online. On March 17th, members of various communities from Halkidikli, Terrace, and Kalikis, all of which would be impacted if Eldorado's proposed mines go ahead, gathered to prepare and strengthen their resistance to the toxic mining. Here's a translation of part of their joint statement. Some see the severe economic crisis as a unique opportunity to curb the resistance of the Greek people and facilitate the pillage of the country. We, the residents of the gold-bearing regions of Greece, say no. We are united in a just struggle against the pillage and destruction of our homelands. Our resistance will keep growing. We are fighting for dignity, freedom, and self-determination. We are fighting for tomorrow, and we shall win. Kodoglou said the anti-mining struggles in northern Greece stand out as a paradigm of community grassroots resistance for the protection of the land and the environment against the aggression of foreign corporations. Recent meetings have brought activists from Bulgaria and Romania to Greece to organize a regional anti-mining network. Quote, the main actions that we organize are demonstrations and protest rallies, meetings where we invite scientists to inform the public on the consequences of such projects, along with screenings of videos from mines around the world. The legal cases are also very important. Kodoglou told the Vancouver Media Co-op, continuing, in the past decade, we have successfully blocked all gold mining projects that have been permitted, unquote. Eldorado Gold has three proposed mines and one producing mine in Greece, and other projects in Romania, Turkey, China, and Brazil, along with the head offices in downtown Vancouver. And a very inspiring story coming from out of the toronto.mediacoop.ca, also written by Tim Groves, is the story of First Nations youth who walk across Ontario to raise attention to mercury poisoning. On June 5th, a group of Six Nations youth completed a 1,900-kilometer walk from Grassy Narrows to downtown Toronto. They undertook the 38-day journey to raise awareness of mercury poisoning that affects their community and the land rights of First Nations. 10 tons of mercury were dumped into the Wabagoon River by the Dryden paper mill between 1962 and 1970. Grassy Narrows and other downstream communities are still feeling the health impacts. We walked to raise awareness about the mercury spilling into the lakes around Grassy Narrows and in North America in general, said Clifford Akubi, a young man from the Swan Lake, Manitoba, who made the walk. Quote, as youth, we are well aware of what the government is doing to our lakes and environment, unquote. Along the walk, they visited several towns and First Nations communities. Each community we went to, we tried to encourage them to stop the trucks from dumping waste in the river and give them courage to speak up and use their voices, explained Akubi. Continuing, it was a healing journey, too. It gives you a chance to dig deep into yourself. When the walkers arrived in Grange Park, about 40 supporters joined them for a barbecue. That evening, 150 people packed the Steel Workers Hall to hear speakers talk about the struggle of people in Grassy Narrows. Quote, I'm really proud of those young people that walked, said Judy De Silva, a mother and blockader from Grassy Narrows. Continuing, all these chemicals are affecting us, and I worry about the young woman, our baby carriers. Nothing is changing. We are still here, and we are still feeling the effects, unquote. On Wednesday, June 6, members of the community are holding a fish fry on the south lawn of Queen's Park, and on June 9, a large festive march took place where over 15,000 square feet of blue fabric rippling in the wind to create a wild river flowed to Queen's Park, where speakers took the stage without response from the Ontario government. This was a follow-up to a continuing campaign at Grassy Narrows. Check out freegrassynarrows.org for more information on that. And we go to statements from Occupy Los Angeles, statements from Decolonize LA. I'm actually not going to read them. I'm just encouraging people to read these statements on escalatingidentity.wordpress.com. That's escalatingidentity.wordpress.com, and it's called Statements from Decolonize Los Angeles at the Paracadistas Collective. It's a good piece, and this webpage, escalatingidentity.wordpress.com, is a very nice webpage for analysis about the Occupy LA ongoing actions and movement there in Los Angeles. We now have a piece from the CBC, and it's been reported that the Ontario coroner, chief coroner, Dr. Andrew McCollum, searched through the records and is adding about 120 possible cases of previously unidentified child and youth deaths linked to the Indian residential school system. Of course, that being the super racist and genocidal project of the Canadian government and the Crown. Oh boy, good work. Moving forward, another piece. And this one is from APTN. It's the Tsleil-Waututh Refuse to Surrender. You can check it. It was posted on the 5th of June, and here it is now.
Holders of Taseko Mines gathered for their annual general meeting in Vancouver. A group of protesters were there to speak out against the company's mining project in northern BC. Although it was turned down a few months ago, the company has been given a second chance to move the project forward. APTN's Tina House has this story.
It was a victory last year when it was announced that the Taseko Mining Company would not be going ahead with their plan to turn Fish Lake into a tailings pond. However, that victory was short-lived. Recently, the company submitted a second plan. Chief Marilyn Baptiste of the Zaniquatine First Nation says the project will still devastate their territory.
Fish Lake would be entirely surrounded by the entire mine, having a 3 kilometer wide pit on one side, having the tailings facility 2 kilometers upstream, and still killing Little Fish Lake, Upper Fish Creek, and Lower Fish Creek. And that basically is 80% of the spawning grounds for the wild rainbow trout that has survived there for many hundreds of years.
Close to 100 supporters came to protest the project, including a group of indigenous people from Mexico and Honduras.
También quieren destruir nuestro sitio sagrado en México.
And so that's why I'm here, to show my support to the Indigenous brothers and sisters of Canada and to let them know that there's also Canadian mining companies that want to destroy our territory in Mexico.
Chief Joe Alphonse from the Chilcotin Nation says the federal and provincial governments want Taseko Mines to move the project ahead. The federal government has announced a streamlined environmental assessment review process for all new resource development. He says the company already has a track record for not involving First Nations in other projects.
And this is a company that already has an existing mine in our territory, and there's no relationship there. So why would we want them to come back in on a new mine in our territory?
Chief Bob Chamberlain also spoke at the event. He says the public needs to be aware of what's happening and the potential environmental devastation by these big projects across the country.
This is nothing short of the new white paper by the Canadian government. Whereas the white paper of 1969 fought and sought to simply do away with Aboriginal rights, in one final swoop, We are now witnessing the incremental removal of all the things between our Aboriginal rights deformed by Canada's own court system. It's a shame. It is absolute shame.
People need to hold the government accountable.
These protesters say they will keep up the protests and are planning future events like this one. Tina House, AP 10 National News, Vancouver.
And following up with that, more protest against Canadian mining companies, this time in Bolivia, as Canadian mining companies don't seem to understand they need to back off of indigenous land. We're bringing up that. Let's, in the meantime, before we get to that, let's bring up a tune. This one is from Caballo and the Mother Fu Kings, and this is Powwow Bounce. Hope you enjoy it. Following the Mother Fu Kings, Powwow Bounce here, AWOL Radio. I was just saying, Bolivians march against Canadian miner. From Euronews.com, this piece is. And members of indigenous communities from the Malclucota region clashed with police officers during a protest in La Paz. They were protesting against mining operations on their lands by the Canadian mining company South American Silver Corporation. And in the video from Euronews, if you check it out, but you see thousands of Bolivian indigenous folks walking into La Paz in three very well-formed lines, all with flags. At one point, the police are start attacking, start grabbing some of them, trying to arrest them, it seems. And we just see vicious attacks to get the police to stop attacking, defending themselves against this police violence, unafraid of what will happen, as they know this is a battle for the existence of their people and their culture, as Canadian mining corporations continue to go into Indigenous communities around the world, and this one is South American Silver Corporation into Indigenous territory in Bolivia. Also, sticking with some info from the South, new aggression in San Jose del Progreso, Oaxaca, posted by Don Paley, and this is a post written by the National Assembly of People Affected by Environmental Conflicts, June 18, 2012. At around 8:10 p.m. on June 16th, the new aggression was carried out against the community of San Jose del Progreso, Oaxaca, by gunmen presumably linked to both the municipal president of San Jose del Progreso, as well as the company Minera Culcatzán, or Fortuna Silver. At about 8:10 p.m., a red Ram truck driven by workers from the mine and city hall, accompanied by underage youth, apparently in a state of inebriation, passed by the Municipal Palace of San Jose, where there were a number of people, we still don't know exactly how many, and they began to shoot. Among the aggressors was a school superintendent, Regidor de Educación, and among the gunmen was someone from the municipal president's office and Evaristo Gonzalez, an employee of the mining company. Bertin Vasquez Ruiz was shot in the abdomen, and another member of COP Yuvo, Guadalupe Vasquez Ruiz, was shot in the leg and the left hand. Both are in hospital, and we have been informed that they are both now in stable condition. The community of San Jose has not had a break all year. In January, Bernardo Mendez was murdered, and Abigail Vasquez Sanchez was wounded. In March, Bernardo Vasquez was murdered, and his brother Andreas and cousin Rosalinda were wounded. The latter is still recovering from the injury to one of her legs. We request that your organizations write letters condemning these acts of violence and circulate them among your contacts and the press. Please circulate this information to your international contacts, especially in Canada. We will try to obtain addresses for Canadian organizations to turn this into an international scandal. And this is from the National Assembly of Environmentally Affected Communities. Check out CENCOS.org for the original on that piece. And as China warns that its rare earth reserves are declining, Northern Ontario First Nations are confronting foreign mining interests. The Martin Falls community must see the benefits if any chromite mining is going to be taking place. Martin Falls First Nation Chief Eli Munia says his Northern Ontario community will need to see the benefits of a multi-billion dollar mining project before it gives its approval, something he says Canada as a whole must also consider. Quote, "We will agree only if our communities will improve," unquote, says the chief. The proposed Cliffs Natural Resources Chromite Mine site is in an area known as the Ring of Fire, about 540 kilometers north of Thunder Bay. The American company plans to remove up to 12,000 tons of ore every day for 30 years. And recently, there was comments by the governments in Canada about heavily pushing northern or developments in the Ring of Fire as they're pushing tar sands development. Quote, "It's not just us that are small, you're small too," Munias told reporters visiting Martin Falls on Thursday, suggesting Canada's best interests don't necessarily harmonize with global trading priorities. Munias said Cliffs intends to export 40% of the chromite it plans to mine near his community to China. "It's done for the many at the expense of the few," he said. Quote, "The language is nearly the same in the way Cliffs talks, in the way the government talks about the proposed mine. Now they want to ship that ore, our ore, your ore, to China," he added. "Now there's lots of people over there, and we're not included in their formula, so just don't call us tiny anymore because you're tiny too." He's demanding a full environmental assessment, and of course, with Bill C-38, they're trying to shut it down. Impacts are likely, of course, and a full environmental assessment, unfortunately, is unlikely. Let's go with another one more land defense story. The Marpole Midden, located in present-day Vancouver, in the heart of traditional unceded Musqueam territory, is an ancient village and burial site of the Musqueam people, dating back at least 4,000 years. In addition to being the sacred resting place of our ancestors, it is recognized as a Canadian National Historic Site. Containing priceless artifacts and undisturbed intact burials of Musqueam people, this site was looted extensively by archaeologists between the late 19th through mid-20th centuries, including the removal of over 100 intact remains for research and storage in museums both locally and internationally. Concurrent to archaeological work, the Marpole Midden has also been impacted by a century of development. A residential condo development is planned for the site, and despite Musqueam objections to the destruction of a sacred site, the province issued archaeological investigation and alteration in December 2011. In January 2012, the intact burial of an ancestor was discovered, and Musqueam wrote to the provincial and federal governments, to the City of Vancouver, and to the developer to resolve the matter through agreement and an appeal made to the Premier, but no meaningful response was received. In early March, news of the burial and continued work on the site prompted band members to protest at the site where construction was ground to a halt to protect their ancestors. This led to a four-week suspension of work on the site, which resulted in no agreement as the province failed to participate in any meaningful way. The developer then continued with work and the band continued to try to bring the province to the table. Continued work on the site unearthed two partially uncovered infant burials. The developer has applied for permission to remove these remains. On May 3, 2012, in response to this development, over 100 Musqueam and supporters marched to the Marpole Midden to demonstrate commitment to the appropriate and respectful care of our ancestors and demand action. Musqueam protesters and supporters continue to maintain a vigil around the clock. Musqueam has proposed a land swap at no cost to taxpayers and the creation of a public heritage park in recognition of the Musqueam cultural history. The park would ensure the long-term protection of the Marpole Midden and provide a space for the citizens of the Musqueam and Metro Vancouver to proudly welcome visitors through the celebration of our ancient roots. This petition calls for the cancellation of the archaeological permits issued by the province and calls on the province to enter into immediate negotiation for a mutually acceptable resolution. And you can sign in. It's on petitionsonlinecanada.com. Stop the immediate destruction of Indigenous burial sites. It's petition 943, and you can sign in in many different ways. I'm going to sign this petition right now since I'm already signed into Google, and I'm going to send it. There is the petition sent. Perfect. Now, taking a page from Canadian policy, Australian Indigenous call money management policy racist. It seems the Australian government is forcing Indigenous people to shop in certain stores and forces them to spend a certain amount of any of the money they're given on certain items. Very racist policies indeed, making it difficult to create a local resilient culture which could stand up to some of this which is happening in, like, some of this destruction, continuing attempts at wiping out Indigenous peoples around the world. Clearly, this Australian government policy is one that is to disempower and to ensure that Indigenous folk in Australia are unable to create local resilient communities. Speaking of, unfortunately, the resiliency is, well, the resiliency is still there, but the habitat is being destroyed as many Alaskan Native communities are facing climate-induced relocation. Native peoples are no stranger to forced relocation. It's a bitter chapter in the history of North American tribal peoples. Now the 21st century version of Native relocation has emerged in Alaska, this time as a consequence of man-made climate change. Climate-induced relocation is cited as one of six key vulnerabilities facing Native communities in the Tribal Chapter of the 2013 National Climate Assessment. Some of the authors of the Tribal Chapter of the 2013 assessment were on hand to present and seek feedback from Indian Country for their final draft at the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Conference in Lincoln, Nebraska, happening June 17, 2012. According to the Tribal Chapter, more than 30 Native villages in Alaska are in need of, or in the process of, relocating their entire villages due to the impact of climate change. The draft cited the Native villages in Alaska, citing melting permafrost, decreased Arctic sea ice, raising sea levels, and shoreline erosions, which have led to flooding, and the destruction of homes and infrastructure in Alaskan villages. public health issues such as loss of clean drinking water, salt water intrusion, and sewage contamination have also risen to disrupt traditional Native Alaskan life. Quote, Alaska is seeing all these things the rest of the country hasn't seen yet, said Dr. Jerome Montague, Native Affairs and Natural Resources Advisor for the Alaskan Command Joint Task Force. The tribal report finds that the United States currently lacks an institutional framework to relocate entire communities and calls for new governance institutions to specifically respond to climate-induced relocation. But because Native peoples have had the historical experience of relocation, they have also learned valuable lessons in adaptability and are not just victims, said Bob Gow, a lead author of the National Climate Assessment and Secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, an organization working to build sustainable tribal economies and tribal energy independence. Gow described the philosophy of Intertribal COOP to tribal workshop participants, quote, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Decisions are going to be made. They should be made with communities. If you're not at the table, they'll be making decisions for you. So it's all about having traditional councils recognized as they carry on. And I suppose good news out of London, Ontario, where a special court has been set up to ensure that GLADU law, which is Supreme Court law that was established to address the historical impacts of colonialism on Indigenous people in our court system. A new, center has been set up, or a new court has been set up to specifically deal with this in London, Ontario. It had to be done, of course. There's recent Supreme Court decisions reasserting the fact that the GLADU decision must be implemented, and that's very good news indeed. A little bit of an anti-colonial discussion here, as Toronto lawyer Charles Roach opened a new chapter in his crusade against the monarchy in Canada when he stepped into an Ontario court on Tuesday, just 2 days after having a minor stroke and 2 months after having a brain tumor removed. Since 1988, the 78-year-old has been fighting to remove the oath to the Queen as a requirement for Canadian citizenship, and had already lost his battle to do so in the federal courts. Mr. Roach wasn't going to let his health stop him from appearing in provincial court for another shot at the monarchy. Quote, Tuesday hearing was particularly important, said Mr. Roach. I just wouldn't have missed it, even if I had to get out of my deathbed. Mr. Roach argued in Ontario Superior Court on Tuesday that making new Canadians pledge their allegiance to the monarchy was unconstitutional. He objects to the monarchy's past connections to slavery and says that a system of hereditary privilege is racist and wrong. Quote, the monarchy is not an equal opportunity kind of institution, said Mr. Roach, who was a born British subject in Trinidad. The Attorney General's lawyers argued that Mr. Roach's case should be tossed out, in part because he already lost a similar claim back in 1994. Peter Rosenthal is representing one of Mr. Roach's three fellow plaintiffs. The justice Tuesday reserved judgment, and we'll hear later about this decision. Very interesting indeed, and a very good point. We're pledging allegiance to the Crown. We're forcing new Canadians to pledge allegiance to the Queen, the Crown, yet we're not pledging allegiance to our treaties. We're not upholding our treaties with the Indigenous people that the government has made, and that we have reaffirmed in such things as the Charter. We're going to go to a song. This is M. Rical, Combien de Mor. AWOL Radio. 100.3 Sound FM, Waterloo, Ontario, Community Co-op Campus Radio, soundfm.ca.
On ne doit pas accepter des déchets qui viennent de d'autres sociétés.
Une balle, deux balles, pas assez de balles, droit. Un mort, deux blessés, l'affaire Villanueva. Un citoyen tué par la police fait l'effet d'un feu de paille. Touchy comme sujet, pars en part, oh bye bye. Plus facile de faire référence à Montréal noir, Montréal nord, Montréal marne, Montréal mort. Plus d'investissement qu'en ces temps, monsieur le maire. Et peut-être que Montréal noir serait Montréal art. Hein. Faut pas trop prendre les citoyens pour des caves. C'est pas juste l'économie qui fait en sorte que l'heure est grave. On veut te faire peur en parlant des gangs de rue. Je suis noir et je t'avoue que moi, j'en ai rarement vu. Mais j'ai connu des hommes qui se sont perdus dans le froid de la rue. Je parlerai pas de gangs, mais je parlerai de mauvais choix d'individus. Blanc, noir, brun, jaune et même bleu. Le crime organisé se fout de ton thème pour mon vieux. Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? C'est pas le citoyen qui est stupide, non. Je crois que c'est le système qui frustre. Va pas vivre là-bas, y'a trop de latinos, trop d'arabes, trop de noirs. C'est pas dans l'absence de couleur que se cache l'espoir. C'est quand la dernière fois que tu t'es fait braquer une arme par une gang de rue de ta belle banlieue agréable. C'est pas que le problème existe pas, c'est qu'il existe presque pas, mais on te le dit pas. Parce que plein de gens tirent bénéfice des problèmes semi-visibles. Moi tout ce que je vois ce sont plein d'organismes mercantiles. La ville de Montréal fait porter le blâme aux enfants. Si Freddy est mort, c'est qu'ils ont agi en délinquant. Nous on voit de l'outrage à la justice et manque d'empathie de la part de celui qui représente le point de vue de la mairie. C'est tannant de constater ce que vit Danny Villanueva. Calmons-nous un moment et pensons vraiment à ceux qu'on élève. On veut le déporter, jeter le bébé avec l'eau du bain. En ne faisant croire que le bébé est pas à nous mais aux voisins. Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? C'est pas le citoyen qui est stupide, non, je crois que c'est le système qui est troué. La police qui enquête sur la police, une grosse job. Commission des droits de la personne, une grosse job. Mandat du protecteur du citoyen, une grosse job. Ministre de la sécurité publique, une grosse job. Décision de pas porter d'accusation, une grosse job. On dirait qu'on prend tous les citoyens pour, une grosse job. Quand servir et protéger est devenu, une grosse job. On ne peut s'empêcher de prendre le système pour, une grosse job. Pas se mentir, le déni ici, ça date pas d'hier. Regardez le traitement réservé aux nations premières. Pourquoi devrait-on espérer avec tant d'impunité? La majorité visible a l'impression dérangée. Si t'es si ouvert d'esprit, mets donc nos noms sur tes boulevards. On veut exister pas seulement dans tes corridors et couloirs. Peut-être que si vous nous verrez aussi comme vos enfants. C'est pourquoi notre Freddy Villanueva est si important. Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? C'est pas le citoyen qui est stupide, non, je crois que c'est le système qui rouille. Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste? Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système? C'est pas le citoyen qui est stupide, non, je crois que c'est le système qui est frustré. Combien de morts va-t-il falloir avoir pour que le système nous donne l'heure juste?
Moi, ma loi, ça serait, tu rentres n'importe qui chez nous, il y en a un dans ta famille qui fait une gaffe, c'est toute ta famille qui retourne à la maison.
Hey, well, radio, that was Emery Cal, combien de morts? You can see that on YouTube.